Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. There are reports today that the CIA and the Treasury Department have been secretly monitoring financial transactions in a huge international database in order to catch terrorists. The Bush administration asked several newspapers not to publish their stories today. Later in the program, we'll speak to one reporter who decided to publish anyway. But first, also today, and on another terrorism front, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said seven men arrested last night were homegrown terrorists who were planning to wage a, quote, full ground war here in the U.S. with the help of the Al-Qaeda terror network. Allegedly, it included blowing up the Sears Tower in Chicago and the FBI building in Miami. But the attorney general said the men were caught early in the planning stage.
They did request materials. They did request equipment. They did request funding. Swore allegiance to Al-Qaeda. We clearly believe there's sufficient information, sufficient facts to support this prosecution.
Well, joining us now on the line from Washington is Chicago Tribune correspondent Jeff Zeleny. And Jeff, earlier reports said these men were not connected to Al-Qaeda. So what did the attorney general say today about how they might have been linked to Al-Qaeda?
A good day. You're right. Early reports yesterday when news was coming out late in the day of the raid on a warehouse in an area of Miami, was that there was not a known link to Al-Qaeda, but in the indictment that was signed off on by a grand jury and was released today by the Attorney General, he said that, in fact, this group had tried to reach out to Al-Qaeda. It's kind of a reverse sort of recruiting, if you will. In previous terrorism investigations, certainly the 9/11 investigation, we learned of Al-Qaeda trying to recruit people. In this instance, at least right now, it appears that this sort of separate group was reaching out to Al-Qaeda to try and get resources and training for a plot to some type of an attack in the U.S., the government says, perhaps on the Sears Tower.
But did the Attorney General have any proof that they actually contacted any real Al-Qaeda operatives or apparently an agent who was pretending to be Al-Qaeda?
At this point, it appears to be the latter, that the leader of one of the groups in December of 2005, so about a year and a half ago, had some contact with a person he thought was an Al-Qaeda member. Of course, as you said, it was actually a government agent who was part of a South Florida terrorism task force. So the Attorney General did not specify any information that he had, or the indictment did not specify any information that this group actually had links to the real Al-Qaeda, if you will.
We understand all of the men are reported to be radical black Muslims, five of them Americans, two Haitian. How did investigators first learn about them? How did they get in touch with them?
Well, in the government's involvement in this began in November of 2005, and a government informant began making contact with one member of the group, and it sort of went from there. A month later, the member asked for uniforms and boots, machine guns and radios, and $50,000 in cash to help him build an Islamic army to wage a jihad against spots in the U.S. But it's one thing that is missing from the indictment and missing from the government's response to this, as we just said a moment ago, it does not appear that there was any connection to or any conversations with real Al-Qaeda operatives. So, I mean, I think it's important to point out at the very, the first 24 hours of any investigation, the stories always generally change, certainly when these cases go to a court of law and if they're prosecuted. So I think it's important to perhaps be a little skeptical of what we're hearing from both sides now.
Well, and Jeff, in just the few seconds we have, you are a correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. One of the targets was allegedly the Sears Tower in Chicago. How are people there reacting?
People are very concerned, as they have been sort of on alert since 9/11. The Sears Tower is the nation's tallest building. But senior law enforcement officials told me last night and again this morning that this plot was in the very infant stages. It was nowhere even a close to being acted upon. So I think that is giving people in Chicago some solace that this is in the very early stages of any type of activity.
Jeff Zeleny, a Washington correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Jeff, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, turning to healthcare, and a unique form of healthcare at that, what can a patient teach a medical student? Some professors at the Harvard Medical School think plenty. We want to spend a few minutes today learning about a course offered at Harvard Medical School here in Boston. It's called Living with a Life-Threatening Illness. It's offered as an elective to first-year med students who are then paired with gravely ill patients in an attempt to teach the future doctor about how patients and their families struggle with serious illness. We gathered three of the course's participants to tell us more: Dr. Susan Block of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and co-director of the course at Harvard. Welcome, Dr. Block.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're also joined by Kyle Stoller. Kyle's a first-year student at Harvard Medical School, and he joins us in the studio as well. Kyle, welcome.
Thank you.
And Kyle, we're joined by someone who I'm guessing is a patient, but who, in theory, is your teacher?
Yeah, definitely. I would say Tim's been a great teacher for me.
Yeah, that's Tim Norton of Southborough, Massachusetts. Tim, you were diagnosed with cancer of the appendix in 2003?
That's right. That's right.
And at what stage is your illness?
It's stage four now.
Yeah.
It's metastatic. It's considered terminal. It's been just about 2.5 years. I went through a period where I did chemotherapy and chemotherapy treatments and surgery initially, had about 5 months of clear scans and clear blood work, and then had a recurrence in late 2004, and have been undergoing treatment ever since then.
So this is the real deal.
It's the real deal.
This is the real deal. How long have you been working with Kyle?
Oh, the beginning of this semester.
Yeah. And so when this prospect entered your life, I mean, here you are, you're dealing with, end-of-life issues.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone also suggested that perhaps a medical student could work with you and you could teach them, what was your thought?
Well, that was Dr. Block. She actually asked me to participate in the program. She explained the program to me, and I was actually happy to do it. You feel like you're giving something back. You feel like you can share some insight that will help them to help a future doctor to be a better doctor. It's pretty easy to see, actually, when you sit down and have a conversation with, for instance, Dr. Block about what the objective of the program is.
Mm. Do you? And obviously it's sounding like you see a need for that. I mean, you've been seeing doctors for a long time.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What's the need?
The need is maybe better emotional connection with your patient. The sense that the patient knows that the doctor isn't just all about killing cancer, but it's also about how you're feeling on that particular day or at any particular time during your treatments. Mm-hmm. The ability to recognize that your emotional well-being plays a big factor in how you feel physically, mm-hmm. because it does.
And Kyle, this is an elective. Why did you take it?
Before medical school, I had read an article somewhere that mentioned that physicians who had patients who were nearing the end of life often withdrew from those patients, be it emotionally or physically, didn't visit the room as often. And I just said to myself, that's not really the type of physician I want to be. And at the same time, I could see exactly why a physician would want to do that, because I think it's a difficult issue. So as soon as I sort of had read about this course, I thought it was a great idea, and I said, this is my chance to not be that physician who withdraws.
Yeah. Dr. Block, it seems as if these programs are a reaction to a problem of doctors, you're nodding your head, yes, doctors really not wanting to be involved as much in end of life.
Well, I think for many years there have been problems in caring for people who approach the end of life, and that have been, documented in the medical literature and become well known to patients and family members who have to go through this process with someone they love. And there's been a real thrust in the past 10 or 12 years to try to make things better with new palliative care programs, educational programs like this one, and so on, that hope to train physicians to move towards people who are suffering rather than to pull away, mm-hmm. as Kyle was saying. And right. this is one small program in what I would say is a big national movement towards improving the care of patients at the end of life.
Do you worry about a doctor's ability to be able to do that? I mean, some of the reasons I'm imagining that doctors do pull back a little bit is that it must be incredibly emotionally draining. You know, maybe they can't afford that if they've got to, you know, carry on with their work. And actually, Kyle, you're nodding yes.
Well, I just, going through Tim's experience, you know, when I meet with Tim on a sort of weekly or biweekly basis, you know, there's really powerful experiences that Tim's going through. And when I'm there, I feel like I'm going through them as well. And it can be something that's definitely pretty difficult and something that's good to talk about in our group when we meet as a group.
Right. And yet, given that it's difficult, why is it good to do it?
I mean, I think, you know, in the first year, you haven't yet been molded into the physician yet, and you sort of you're impressionable, and you know, it's a real opportunity to try and be comfortable with these issues now, yeah. because you are going to deal with them eventually.
Well, Tim, what are some of the things that you talked to Kyle about over the last semester? What are some of the issues?
Boy, we've covered a lot. I think one of the common themes that we talked a lot about was the effect it has on my family, on my wife and my children, and the effect that it has on me, considering what effect it has on my family. You know, I have two daughters, an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old, and a wife who is my primary caretaker and who does it all. So it's very, you know, it's a very emotional thing. It's something that is always on your mind as far as what effect your illness is having on the rest of your family and how to best address that. You know, is it fair to your wife that she does just about everything that maybe you used to be able to contribute and do around the house? Is it fair that you can't help your kids with their homework because you just don't feel good that particular night and they have to wait until mom gets home? I'm not so sure that I would discuss those topics with my doctor. I discussed them with my student to maybe shed the light on the fact that these are things that in his future career he's going to have to consider, that his patient goes home and those are the kinds of things that he thinks about. It isn't always, Jesus, is the cancer going to spread and am I going to be dead in 2 months or 2 weeks or 2 years? In fact, I spend less time thinking about when I'm going to die versus the journey to get there and what effect it's having really on my family.
That's Tim Norton. His cancer is in stage 4. It's terminal. He is a patient, but he's also become the teacher in a class offered to first-year medical students at Harvard Medical School. We've also been speaking with Dr. Susan Block from the school and first-year med student Kyle Stoller. When we come back, what impact has it had on Kyle to learn about Tim's family issues? Something he'll probably never hear about as he does rounds as a resident. Also, don't forget, later in the program, the New York Times reporter Eric Lischblau on why his paper published today's piece on the secret government program that mines international money transactions. The White House asked him not to report it. Much more coming up here and now. Young. It's here and now, and we're talking about how patients living with a terminal illness can instruct future doctors. A class called Living with Life-Threatening Illness is offered to first-year med students at Harvard Medical School, and we've been speaking with Dr. Susan Block, who is co-director of the course, and Tim Norton of Southborough, Massachusetts. Tim is both patient and teacher in the course. And this spring semester, he's been working with first-year med student Kyle Stoller. So, Kyle, before the break, Tim was talking about how it helps him to talk to you about different things, like the burden Tim feels his illness has placed on his wife and children. But what do you get from this experience?
Well, I think one of the great things about working with Tim is I realized that when Tim comes in for a clinic appointment, he may spend 20 minutes at the most with his physician, and that's sort of a brief window that physician has into Tim's life, and there's just so much going on. It's the tip of the iceberg, essentially. I was fortunate to travel out to Tim's home in Southborough and meet his kids and meet his family, and And then coming back and going to have I think it was a blood transfusion with Tim was really a powerful experience, because he was sort of, okay, I had seen this sort of outside world. I was able to relate it to my own experiences.
I was going to ask you about that, because doctors today rarely go to the home of a patient. And what, how, you know, that sounds like it really impacted you, maybe changed the way. It sounds as if you might view a patient in a more holistic way, as part of a family group instead of just this, you know, unit that passes through.
I mean, I think that's definitely the case. I just have this image of one of Tim's daughters helping Tim's on total parenteral nutrition. He's fed through a tube, and he sort of carries this backpack around with him a lot. And he has, when I saw, I had this vision in my head of one of his daughters sort of helping him flush out the tube, and it was sort of this photographic image that was caught in my mind. And just to spend time with his family, and his mother-in-law was there, and people came by, and it was just really sort of put together Tim as a whole person.
Yeah. And Dr. Block, you've written that med students traditionally want to avoid this, the sadness and the idea of hopelessness at the end of life of a patient. Many young people haven't seen death yet, whether or not they're med students. Yeah. So how do you help them, you know, with what's going to be the end of a deep friendship?
Well, you know, I think students who take this kind of course are pretty courageous to be putting themselves in a position where they're going to be subject to a lot of kind of emotional ups and downs that go with developing a close relationship with someone and coming to care for them. And I think that students are going to encounter death whatever they do in medicine. Most of the time when they encounter death in the hospital, they're not going to have a lot of emotional support to kind of deal with the experiences, the issues that it might stir up in them. I think we provide the students with a kind of safe setting for them to explore their own feelings about death, to sometimes go back over past losses that have happened in their own lives, mm-hmm. to understand how people want to live with an illness, that the focus is on the living, as Tim was saying earlier, not on the dying, even though the dying shadows everything.
Right. Tim, I saw you nodding your head, you know, more about life than about the death. And I wonder if this could maybe shake up the thinking of students about what they learn in med school, you know, that intervention is always the key, when in fact some patients don't want intervention anymore, or the opposite, you know, when, you know, a patient might be written off as not worthy of any more medical treatment, when in fact there's a valuable life that could be extended.
Yeah. I think, I haven't been there yet, but my sense is that I think in every terminal patient's experience, there comes a point in time where you know that the end is, you know, the end is near, or that it's time. And I think you as a patient probably get pretty comfortable with that if you have the benefit of having good psychiatric care and somebody like a Kyle or a doctor that can help you through that.
Well, Kyle, tell us about another aspect of this class. You not only meet with Tim, but you meet in a group with Dr. Block and other first-year students who are also assigned to patients.
We just sort of discuss the day-to-days of meeting with our patients and people like Tim and what's going on in our lives and how we're struggling to deal with some of the issues that we come across. And different days will bring different sort of, I guess I'd call them crises, with different members of the group. And we all work together to sort of to work through those things with each other.
What are some of the things that have come up in the group?
Patients passing has been something that's come up in the group and obviously is a very powerful experience. Things that don't go as well when patients and their students don't get along as well. How do we approach those issues? And I think those are also instructional.
Yeah, like that, now what would some of the issues be that, you know, wouldn't work as well?
You know, I think it's just like any sort of relationship. Tim and I have built a great relationship and we get along well and that's been a great experience. But I think it's also a powerful experience when you might not get along as well, when it just, the chemistry isn't necessarily there right off the bat, mm-hmm. and you really need to struggle to try to get some of the information out of your patient.
Have you seen Kyle? What have you seen from your end?
Well, Kyle impressed me from the very beginning, actually. I mean, he's a very astute individual. He's got great listening skills, and he's sharp. So, you know, we've only known each other probably 3 months. 4 months, and I think he's going to make a great doctor. I enjoy spending time with them, and I think it's really beneficial for somebody like Kyle to experience what I'm going through.
And so it sounds like beneficial for you, yeah.
Yeah, so it makes me feel good. I mean, and it makes me feel all that much better that a patient down the road is going to benefit from that.
That's Tim Norton. He is Kyle Stoller's teacher, if you will, taking part in a course at Harvard Medical School called Living with Life-Threatening Illnesses. Tim Norton is undergoing a tough battle with a terminal illness right now, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
We also spoke with Kyle Stoller, first-year medical student at Harvard from Beverly, Massachusetts. Kyle, best to you.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Susan Block, chief of the Division of Psychosocial Oncology and Palliative Care at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. Dr. Block, thanks.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Young, it's here and now. Today, the Bush administration is defending a formerly secret program that allows the U.S. to track terrorist financing around the globe by gaining access to bank records from a vast international database without the knowledge of many banks and their customers. Several newspapers reported on the program today, prompting outgoing Treasury Secretary John Snow to respond. He says the program has helped make Americans safer.
By following the money, we've been able to chart the terrorist networks, and we've been able to bring the terrorists to justice.
Here's how the U.S. program works. The Treasury Department subpoenas vast numbers of records from the global nerve center of the banking industry, a Belgian consortium called the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, or SWIFT. About 13 million bank records pass through SWIFT every day. The CIA crunches the information and looks for possible ties to terrorist organizations. This is the latest in a series of revelations about secret government monitoring programs, including a warrantless wiretapping program, which allows the U.S. to monitor some calls and emails. Well, joining us on the line is New York Times national reporter Eric Lichtblau, who broke the warrantless wiretapping story and reported today on SWIFT. Eric, can you tell us how the SWIFT program got started?
So it was a program that was started just a few weeks after 9/11, and they have obtained large volumes of records from SWIFT through broad administrative subpoenas, getting millions of records at a time, and then using intelligence leads on people suspected of having ties to terrorism or terrorist financing, and searching, querying the database to see what account numbers were used, what transactions were made, and to try and trace the money.
Do your sources tell you that it's ever been successful in tracking anyone?
We have been told about several successes. The biggest one clearly seems to have been the capture of an al-Qaeda operative in Southeast Asia known as Hambali, who is considered the mastermind of the Bali hotel attacks. The tracing of financial transactions through Thailand appears to have allowed intelligence officials to locate and capture him in 2003. Domestically, the successes have not been quite as dramatic. There's one specific case that appears to have grown directly out of this program involving a man in Brooklyn who was doing business with people overseas in Pakistan and was convicted last year on terrorism-related charges.
Right. Well, Eric, let's take a step back. Can you describe exactly what SWIFT is?
SWIFT is a group that very few people have heard of, but which plays a critical part in the world banking community by routing message traffic among banks and financial institutions. If you want to do business in the global marketplace, you basically have to route your information through SWIFT. It basically tells one bank how to send money to another bank.
It's based in Belgium, and you write that, in fact, this is how Treasury officials have explained that they feel that SWIFT is exempt from U.S. laws because it is a message service and not, say, a bank.
Right. They cite a couple of exemptions. That's one of them, that it would not be covered by, for instance, the Right to Financial Privacy Act, which applies to the records of customers at banks and financial institutions. SWIFT itself and Treasury officials view the company as more of a messaging service or a telecom company providing information without actually moving money.
And let's be clear. These are largely international movements of money and funds. This isn't, you know, if I go to the ATM, this isn't tracking that.
As a general matter, no. SWIFT does do some business exclusively within the United States. A small portion of its business would be domestic to domestic. But your general routine banking at an ATM or through your local bank would not be included. If you are sending money or doing business overseas, however, or getting money from overseas, it almost certainly would go through SWIFT.
Well, we understand from your reporting as well that you began to learn about this from sources within these different agencies who had their own concerns about something that was started up right after 9/11 in the mood of the day, but continued on longer than many thought it would.
Yeah, one concern that was pretty evident was that this had begun as an emergency and in many respects understandable response to 9/11 that was seen as a temporary solution. And there were people in the government who saw that it had essentially become permanent nearly 5 years after 9/11. And the company itself, to be honest, some people there at SWIFT held that view. And as we say in today's story, the company in 2003, it indicated it was considering pulling out of the arrangement altogether because they saw this as a temporary arrangement that was beginning to feel permanent to them. And they agreed to continue the arrangement only after a series of very high-level meetings in Washington in 2003 with a number of officials, including Alan Greenspan, then the Fed chairman, and Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI.
And we understand as well from various reports that the CIA had been trying to, you know, figure out clandestine ways to get to the SWIFT network, in the late 1990s, before 9/11. But there was thinking in the government that, the U.S. did not want to sort of undermine or anger the international banking community, and that's why this became a Treasury Department program.
Right. As we reported, there were discussions immediately after 9/11 about the possibility of a covert program to gain access to SWIFT system without its direct knowledge or participation. It was felt by policymakers outside the CIA, principally at the Treasury Department, that it made more sense to go in the front door, and in the view of the government, SWIFT was turned out to be a willing partner in this. Although SWIFT maintains that its cooperation in this was never voluntary, and that it was responding only to a valid subpoena and was required to do so.
As you well know, the Bush administration asked the New York Times and other media organizations not to publish this information about the use of the SWIFT network because the program has been successful and will become jeopardized if it's going to go public. Why did your paper decide to go ahead and publish this information anyway?
You know, we certainly thought long and hard about that, and the arguments in the NSA case and this one were somewhat similar in that regard, in that the interest and ability of the government to either wiretap through the NSA or to look at your financial records is widely known. In the opinion of just about everyone we talk to, the terrorists are well aware of that. That their transactions can be and most likely are being traced.
And that brings the question, you know, the Bush administration is saying that your article and other articles are alerting the terrorists that this program's taking place. Well, it's definitely alerting clients of SWIFT that it's taking place. We assume clients that use SWIFT expect confidentiality in their banking transactions. So does this program, the U.S. program of mining the information from SWIFT, undermine the integrity of SWIFT?
There is an expectation among SWIFT's thousands of members that their records are kept confidential. In fact, they're encrypted for just that purpose, so that no one at SWIFT is supposed to see them. So, you know, there certainly will be questions in the financial industry about how this all plays out.
Eric Lischblau of the New York Times, thanks very much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And still to come today, the American who became a superstar behind the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall. You're listening to Here and Now. cynics who think modern art is a lot of, well, garbage, have new proof. Justin Jenak, now an advertising art director in New York City, has been literally peddling trash since he was a marketing wannabe back in 2001. What he does is he puts on thick gloves and trolls the city streets, picking up tissues and food wrappers and discarded Broadway and baseball tickets. Ooh. Then he packages them all together in small, square, clear plastic cubes and sells them for as much as $100 a pop. Justin joins us on the line. And, Justin, I've got to say, this is disgusting. How do you do this? Pick through garbage.
I have a really weak stomach, so I don't know how I ever, like, came upon this or why I would do this, but for some reason it's actually worked out pretty well so far.
Well, let's stay with that, though. I mean, there must be a reason. Why did you do this?
Well, initially I had a summer internship, and someone was, at the internship, was discussing the importance of packaging and said packaging wasn't important, and I disagreed with that. So I figured the only way to test that theory was to try to package something that absolutely nobody would ever want. And if I could actually get them to buy it, then I knew my package design was successful.
Next, the Brooklyn Bridge. Because,
yeah, pretty much.
Because people are buying them at, what, $20 to $100 a pop, we understand?
Now they're, the regular garbage is $50, and limited edition trash from opening day Yankee Stadium is $100.
Oh, so it's gone up since we first read about it. You've got a website where you can see some of these things. And I'm sorry, you know, cigarette butts, discarded tickets. It just sounds disgusting. What are some of the other things you put in there?
I put anything from lotto tickets and pieces of newspaper. I always like when I find stuff that's actually come from real people. So I found day planners on the street and broken cell phones and photographs and love notes and all that. So it's kind of fun to put that in when you know it actually comes from a person and it tells a little bit of a story. And whenever I pick up trash, I only pick up dry garbage, so it's not as disgusting as you'd think.
Oh, it is so. It's so disgusting.
Well, I guess it is disgusting, but it's all dry and it doesn't smell at all. So when you put all the things together in the cube, it's actually kind of aesthetically pleasing.
Right, you pack them in these airtight cubes, these squares, much as someone might put a baseball, you know, in something for preservation. What do people say when they buy it?
Well, it's funny. It's like, you know, I wasn't sure when I first started doing it if anybody would buy them, but the reaction's been amazing. And when I actually have them, I've gone out in the streets and sold them, and I have 20 or so out there with me, and people spend so much time trying to find the perfect cube for them. You know, and they almost have like an emotional connection with one, and once they find it, it's like they have to have it. So it's really weird just to see, you know, how people respond to it, but it's been pretty cool.
Is it art or con art?
Well, I actually do think it's art. It's taking something that at one point nobody even cared about. You know, they just threw it away, and something that is considered, you know, kind of disgusting and something easy to look over. And I've got it to a point where people feel like they need to have it and need to show it off. You know, and I got people to view garbage in a different way. So I do think it's art.
Well, what do you think it is about the fact that it's from New York? You know, I mean, I'm wondering if somebody would try this in Fort Lauderdale, you know, and have the same result. What do you think?
Well, the thing is, like, New York's famous for our trash. You know, you come here and that's all you see. When I was initially doing this, I figured people go to Florida and they buy Sunlight in a can and they buy, you know, jars of sand. So why wouldn't they come to New York and buy garbage?
Oh, I can think of a million reasons. I can just, you know, having lived there. What's the strangest thing you've put in?
I found a piece of Heidi Klum's mail, the famous supermodel. It's like a junk mail for a long distance rates or something. And so I found a piece of that and I threw it in. And I found right around the Republican National Convention. I found champagne glasses, and so it's been pretty interesting to see what I come across.
And do I understand? I mean, when you started this, you wanted to be in advertising. Is this in part how you got your job?
Yeah, well, when I first started, I was, you know, sophomore and junior in college, you know, hoping to get an ad job. And, you know, it's pretty much helped me land all three of my jobs. I'm not trying to make my living off of it, so it's been pretty fun. And, you know, hopefully I'll be able to expand the empire. I've gotten people who want to be franchisees in different cities across the world. So, you know, I think that's my next big step.
Well, that's Justin Jenak. He is an advertising art director, but also creator of, what do you call them, Justin?
New York City Garbage Sculptures, and it's nycgarbage.com.
There you go. If anyone's interested. Justin, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Stay with us. Up next, Dean Reed, the superstar we never heard of. That's coming next, Here and Now. Thank you. Robin Young, It's Here and Now, and he may be the most famous rock star you've never heard of. In the late 1950s, Dean Reed was an aspiring Hollywood actor, gorgeous in a Glen Campbell kind of way. He had both movie and recording contracts, but he moved to South America, then to the Soviet Union, where he became the Red Elvis and had a smashing success with songs such as Maria from West Side Story.
Maria, I've just met a girl named Maria, and suddenly that name will never be the same to me.
Dean Reed's pictures were sold alongside those of Stalin. He sang Ghost Riders in the Sky for Yasser Arafat and appeared on 60 Minutes to defend the Berlin Wall. Then, in 1986, he was dead, a mysterious drowning in the lake behind his East Berlin home. Author Reggie Nadelson tells Dean's story in Comrade Rockstar, The Life and Mystery of Dean Reed, the all-American boy who brought rock and roll to the Soviet Union. It's just released in a new edition in the U.S., and Reggie joins us from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York with more. Welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
You first saw Dean Reed in a 60 Minutes story in 1986, before he died. Your reaction sounds a lot like mine when I read a review of your book, which was, say what? You know, there's this huge rock star and I didn't know about him.
I think that was everybody's reaction. I mean, virtually nobody in the West knew about him. He'd gone to South America and then to Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union in the early and mid-60s and really never came home. I mean, he remained a U.S. citizen, but he disappeared over the other side of the Berlin Wall.
And he became quite a mouthpiece for the governments that he visited. And how did this happen? Because you describe a fairly normal American upbringing in Colorado. How did he become a revolutionary?
I think it was a series of things. He went to Hollywood. He was marginally successful, but found it, as so many people have, very tough. Had this teacher who became a tremendous mentor, Peyton Price, who was, I don't know whether he was a communist or a socialist, but certainly was a lefty and preached a kind of idealism to his students. And Dean then, he was an impatient boy, and he heard he had a hit in Chile. And so he got in his white Chevy Impala convertible and drove to Chile. And when he got there, he discovered he was enormous. He had a hit called My Summer Romance, and it was the 60s, and I guess he saw the writing on the wall, and it said, Yankee, go home, and he was taken up by all the forces of the revolution and people wearing Che berets and was hooked.
And why did they like him so much? Put this in context for us. For instance, in the Soviet Union.
They liked him because he was an American. And I think that by around the middle 60s, the kids and an awful lot of urban people loved everything about America, certainly in terms of culture and style. They were fed up with the drabness of the Soviet Union. And here comes this handsome, blue-eyed American singing Beatles covers. And the establishment is allowing him to perform.
And singing, perhaps dangerously so, Motown. We have a little from a compilation of his songs. Let's listen to Dean Reed's cover of The Four Tops, Can't Help Me.
Hey, sugar pie, honey bunch. You know that I love you. Oh, I can't help myself. I love you and nobody else. Yeah, 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 yeah. In and out my life. Come and you go. Leaving just your...
Oh, boy. Reggie Nadelson, you know, he was talented, but it comes off years later as just a little bit cheesy.
First of all, you have to put yourself into the Soviet Union in 1966. It's quite a different situation. I mean, there was tremendous sophistication, of course, about classical music, but almost none about rock and roll and pop culture, certainly outside very, very tiny enclaves of people in probably only in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And so, of course, it didn't come off cheesy to them. It was really his enthusiasm and his charm that mattered, not his singing talent.
He ended up living in East Germany. We have a little sound of him there. And you have to picture this. It's from a video that's online. It's a concert in East Germany. He comes out on the stage on a horse, in a suit, bow tie, cowboy hat, and guitar on the horse. lip syncing. Let's listen.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.
Here I come, here I come, here I come.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. They got some crazy little women there, and I'm gonna get me one.
He's singing about going back to Kansas City. Did he want to return to the United States?
Yes, he did. In his last couple of years, he came home and visited some friends in Colorado, and I think he fell in love with America again. But, of course, there wasn't much road for a 47-year-old has-been rock star to travel at that point.
Even if he was a huge rock star still around the world.
Well, he wasn't still such a huge rock star around the world by his last couple of years. Gorbachev came in 1985. Things began to loosen up. People had their own rock stars. I mean, the Soviet Union had fantastic singers of their own who sang in Russian to young kids who didn't know about these kind of officially sponsored singers like Dean Reed. So I think he was famous, but his popularity was waning, and he increasingly played to empty stadiums.
As the politics that he embraced seemed to be waning as well, and you know, it reminds us that he did that 60 Minutes interview that caught your attention just weeks before he died. And in that interview, he defended the Berlin Wall.
Yes, he did, and I think it was a dreadful mistake for him. It really was, and perhaps sunk his chances of coming back to America.
So, as you write, several weeks later, he's dead, a mysterious drowning. You spent a considerable amount of time investigating his drowning. What conclusion do you come to? Was his drowning an accident, a suicide, a murder?
I think it was a suicide of some kind. I think there was really nowhere left for him to go, both literally and metaphorically.
Hmm. So Dean Reed's star was fading, but you'd learned that it wasn't always bright with everyone. You had a very strange encounter with Vladimir Posner, who many Americans remember as the Phil Donahue of the Soviet Union during the Cold War era. But you found out that Posner actually grew up in the same Greenwich Village neighborhood as you did. He had Pete Seeger for a teacher as a child. And he hated Dean Reed. Why did he hate him?
He's a man of very good musical taste, and Dean Reed was crap. Because Posner had grown up in New York, he knew the difference. He wasn't exactly impressed by this pretty American boy who sang. I mean, you played some of Dean Reed's better songs. His own compositions are really quite stunning. Things like Female Hercules.
And he also felt that Dean was used by the Soviet regime. Do you think that that was it? Do you think they used him, or do you think that they truly loved having him there?
Both. I mean, I think they truly loved having him, and he was very, very useful. I don't think the apparatchiks of the Soviet Union just sort of fell in love with people and said, come on over and have some fun. I mean, he was obviously useful to them, and the irony became that the kids were only allowed him because he was official, and they only wanted him because they thought he was seditious.
Author Reggie Nadelson, her book, Comrade Rockstar, The Life and Mystery of Dean Reed, the all-American boy who brought rock and roll to the Soviet Union. Reggie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
For more on Dean Reed, go to our website, here-now.org.
I want you to know that clouds don't cry. I want you to know.
Fascinating story. Here and Now, a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a good weekend and join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.